morning. It's 7 a.m. Today is October 21st, 2020. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez. Coming up next, A New Day. Today on the show, we turn to an important and riveting interview I conducted with Dr. William Robinson, a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And we talked about the economic underpinnings of the fascist movement that threatens us here in the United States and people around the world. Part of what Dr. Robinson argues is that a deep crisis in capitalism and capitalism's inability to minimally meet the needs of masses of people is what propels capital and its managers to find in fascism a means of consolidating power. Stay tuned for headlines. Labor activists say they are prepared for a general strike in the event that Trump refuses to leave office if he loses the November election, as he has threatened numerous times. On October 8th, the Central Labor Council in Rochester, New York, resolved to call, quote, on the national AFL-CIO, all of its affiliate unions, and all other labor organizations in the United States of America, to prepare for and enact a general strike of all working people, if necessary, to ensure a constitutionally mandated peaceful transition of power as a result of the 2020 presidential elections, unquote. The Rochester Central Labor Council of the AFL-CIO represents over 100,000 workers in the building trades, in manufacturing, in the public sector, in the federal sector, in healthcare and other service jobs. The Rochester Central Labor Council explained that, quote, the most powerful tool of the labor movement in our history has been the power of the general strike. United working people refusing to work across the nation have a greater power than any political machinations of aspiring despots, unquote. Take a listen to Dan Maloney. Dan Maloney is the president of the Rochester Labor Council, and he's also the president of UAW 1097. And he's speaking about the meaning of this resolution.
We oppose authoritarianism and totalitarianism, and we are here to fight against it and ensure the institutions of democracy in our nation remain vigorous. And, I mean, one of the tools that we can use to ensure that is the power of a national strike. When unions are being, when they're under threat, when they're being gutted, they can always just refuse to pick up the garbage, let it pile up, and typically that brings people to the bargaining table and to common sense solutions in negotiations. So this man, showing he's a tyrant, you have to take strong action to be able to beat him back at his own game. So if that means everything stops across this country, which we can in labor and other people of good conscience, in this case, put down your tools, right? Do not drive the rig. Airplanes don't go up. Trains don't move. Garbage doesn't get picked up. Nothing gets built. Nothing gets sold. Nothing gets transported. We can do that.
And that was Rochester Labor Council President and UAW 1097 President Dan Maloney speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer this week about the central role that labor must play if Trump were to decide to stay in office after a lost election. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day. And now we turn to an important and riveting interview I conducted with William Robinson this week. Last we spoke to Dr. William Robinson in April of this year, he had just published an essay titled A Disease Deadlier Than COVID-19, Global Capitalism in Crisis. Dr. Robinson is professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His latest book, The Global Police State, was published by Pluto Press this year. Professor Robinson has been warning us about the threats of a creeping fascist movement across the globe. Oh, since at least the last global recession of 2008, he's been writing about fascism and its spread and its threats across the globe. He offers, in my opinion, one of the clearest explanations of the economic and political underpinnings of fascism. And in this interview, we explore capitalism's deepening crisis of overaccumulation. That is, that capitalism has not been able to find outlets for capital investment. And this has in turn led to stagnation in the global capitalist economy. That overaccumulation is worsened by low wages across the world, which prevent the mass of working people across the globe from purchasing the goods produced by capitalism. That's because capitalism is constantly seeking to lower production costs, and it lowers wages such that workers who are engaged in the process of production, the production of the goods that capitalism sells in the world market at a profit, can't themselves purchase those goods. In fact, a significant percentage of the world's working class lives in conditions of precarity. That means that they are chronically unemployed or underemployed or barely eking out a living on poverty wages. Professor Robinson paints a picture of the savage wealth inequality of our time in this interview, one in which billionaires have seen their wealth increase by 30% since the pandemic. That while so many go without right here in this country as a result of mass unemployment and low wages. He discusses briefly the contemporary reorganization of capitalism, which in fact has accelerated in this moment of pandemic. That reorganization has come in the form of the fourth industrial revolution, a revolution in production organized around digital technology and artificial intelligence. Of course, with connections to the military-industrial complex. And just for background and perspective, recall that the first industrial revolution, which started in England, was organized around the steam engine. That's in the 18th century. The second industrial revolution was driven by the invention of steel, and that happened in the 19th century. And in fact, it was the second industrial revolution that propelled the United States to the status of one of the most productive countries in the world. We were producing at that moment more goods in the United States than could be absorbed domestically, and that led to U.S. expansion, imperial expansion in Latin America and beyond. The third industrial revolution was one driven by computers, and the fourth industrial revolution is driven by digital technology, and that's part of what we're going to hear about in this interview. Dr. Robinson helps us understand the links between capitalism and crisis because of this tendency to overaccumulate and the threat of fascism. So the links between capitalism in deep crisis and the threat of capitalism, which essentially is a political movement of last resort used by capitalists to consolidate power and avert challenges to the system, progressive challenges to the system from below. We end with a discussion of the kind of movement we need to arrest the creeping fascist movement we see and are threatened by domestically and worldwide. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day.
Professor Robinson, welcome to A New Day.
Thank you for having me on.
Can you give us a sense of the current state of the domestic and global economy?
Sure. Well, we want to link the domestic and global economy to the larger story of the crisis of global capitalism. And while that has many different dimensions, including, of course, ecological, we want to link two. One is the structural dimension of that crisis, what we call overaccumulation or chronic stagnation in the global economy. And of course, that includes the U.S. domestic economy. The other dimension of the crisis is political, a crisis of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony. And these two dimensions can't be separated from one another. But you're asking me about the state of the domestic and global economy in the context of the pandemic. And we want to remember that the global economy was already moving into recession and was already in this deep structural crisis that I just mentioned before the pandemic. The pandemic did not create this economic holocaust that we're in right now. It only made it much more worse. Even if we get a vaccine in, let's say, spring of 2021 and mass vaccinations begin, we're going to be in an economic depression, one that might be more severe for a number of reasons than the 1930s. And this is going to go on for years, certainly 2, 3, 4 years, maybe 5 years. But here's the other thing. We're going to emerge on the other side of a mass vaccination campaign, assuming that takes place, with an economy that's much more unequal, and an economy which is will be experiencing and already is an accelerated restructuring towards a situation where the rich are much richer, and the tech giants and the banks and the military-industrial complex greatly enhanced power and control over all of us. I think you're familiar. The listeners must be familiar with the data on how we've already, before the pandemic, we are already living with unprecedented inequalities in the history in which we have records, the history of humanity, where 1% of humanity, and again, this is not the pandemic, this is prior, controls well over 50% of the world's wealth, and 80% of humanity, but that's a figure which is decreasing, meaning, 20% of humanity, and that number is decreasing to 15-12% of humanity, controls 95% of the world's wealth. So 80% of humanity has only 5% of the world's wealth. So during the pandemic, this savage inequality has intensified. And your listeners may be familiar with the report that in the first 6 months of the pandemic in the United States, U.S. billionaires' wealth grew by $845 billion. I mean, I have the article right here in front of me, a 30% increase in their wealth. The 643 of the U.S.'s richest billionaires rose from $2.95 trillion to $3.8 trillion. And this, of course, is at a time when now tens of thousands of people may be evicted and literally be homeless, when 50,000 people lost their jobs. Some of it got it back. Most people have not gotten the job back, or they've gotten different jobs which are precarious, where there is this health crisis. Everything going on, the billionaire class in the United States increased their wealth by some $1 trillion. So you have intensified economic and social inequality. And that reflects worldwide. There's another article came out just at the same time, and this is just last week. These are new two reports. Billionaires' wealth worldwide during this pandemic rose to $10.2 trillion, which is a 30% increase worldwide. So,
Professor Robinson, how do you explain that? Can you give us a sense of the ABCs of this massive transfer of wealth amidst pandemic? How does that happen mechanically on the ground?
Certainly. Well, we want to start by recognizing that capitalism, left to its own devices, the intrinsic function of capitalism, left to its own devices, is to polarize wealth, to generate a tremendous amount of wealth, but have that polarized at one end with the 1%, with billionaires and millionaires, with capitalists. And the other end is ever increasingly immiserated. Marx analyzed that scientifically and rigorously in his three volumes of Capital. But during the 20th century, and by the way, that immiseration thesis was demonstrated in the earlier centuries of capitalism, and of course continues to be demonstrated worldwide in the global south. But in the 20th century, in the rich countries, mass trade union struggles, mass socialist and communist struggles, mass anti-racist struggles, feminist struggles, the explosions of the 1960s and 70s coming on the heels of those mass struggles of the 1930s, forced at the level of the nation state, forced the capitalist state to redistribute wealth downwards. So standards of living started to rise in the rich countries in the 20th century. Capitalist globalization is launched at the end of the 20th century, and essentially capitalist groups launch globalization to escape any constraint at the level of the nation state, to be able to reestablish their own class power, because mass social movements, trade union worker struggles, political struggles take place at the level of the nation state. But capital goes global. It can get around the pressures that the forces from below cannot put on the nation state. And so that's why we have the spiraling inequality from the 1980s or the early 1990s right up until to date. It's the natural tendency of capitalism now liberated from state constraints at the level of each country. But then you're asking me why this even intensifies further during the pandemic. And what is happening is that this restructuring of capitalism, a new wave of restructuring has begun just a few years ago, based on a much greater digitalization of the whole global economy and society, and based on fourth industrial revolution technologies, which includes machine learning and artificial intelligence. This massive collection, processing analysis of unbelievable amounts of data, driverless vehicles and drones and so forth and so on. So that restructuring based on this dramatic new intensification of digitalization was already going on. And it's accelerated under the pandemic because these digital technologies controlled by the giant tech companies, financed by the banks, linked to the military-industrial complex, have occupied center stage during the pandemic, because everyone, you're working at home or you're getting your deliveries at home, and everyone suddenly needs to use Zoom. You and I are speaking on Zoom. Public and private educational systems go on to Zoom. So the giant tech companies, which are pushing this deep digitalization even before the pandemic, become much more powerful, accumulated tremendous amount of wealth in the context of what was already this dramatic polarization of wealth, and at the same time that all around the world, 500 to 800 million people lost their job, including here in the United States, and several hundreds of millions more who weren't employed, but rather surplus humanity scratching out a living in informal sectors, faced lockdowns, faced the inability of to operate even in the informal sector. So it's not surprising that the pandemic rapidly accelerates what's already this process of unprecedented inequality. I hope my response is not too technical, but I think it's really important that we understand the link between the danger of fascism, so imminent right now in the United States, political and social conflict that we're seeing, the anti-racist struggle that exploded a few months ago, the link between all of that and the capitalism and its crisis. And I think that's been missing in a lot of the left and progressive discourse and analysis.
You're listening to the voice of Professor William Robinson, and we're talking about the current economic and political conjuncture in the context of a pre-existing crisis in capitalism, a crisis of overproduction. Would you characterize it as a crisis of overproduction? And we're about to talk about the rise of fascist currents domestically and around the world within the context of this deep crisis in capitalism. And Professor Robinson is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Yeah. Well, let me, if I could, let me talk about this crisis of overproduction and then show how it is linked to the threat of fascism, if that's okay. And yes, you are right. This is a crisis of overproduction, but the more technical term I would use is overaccumulation. So right. But in simplified terms, what is going on here is that we just saw 80% of humanity, 20% of humanity, a figure which is diminishing, controls 95% of the world's wealth. And 80% has only 5%, so that 80% cannot consume. So we face this situation in which the global economy pours out an immense amount of wealth, of goods and services that people want and need. But the global market cannot absorb that. So capitalists have been accumulating massive profits. The last latest figure I have is just in the United States, $11 trillion. Corporations are sitting on uninvested cash, just cash reserves of $11 trillion. They can't reinvest it in the productive economy because the mass of humanity cannot consume. And so that is overproduction. So that leads to stagnation. If capital holds on to its capital rather than investing the capital and deepening and pushing forward the process of accumulation, if it does that, then we enter into stagnation, recessions and depressions. And we were already headed there before the pandemic. Now we're fully there. The pandemic pushed us over the cliff and we were right at the edge of the cliff. So that is the structural crisis of overproduction involving stagnation, but involving the intensified levels of misery for the vast majority of humanity. Capitalists personally are not in crisis. They have all of their wealth. They live in their mansions, their penthouses. They're speculating wildly on the stock market. But the crisis of stagnation in the real economy affects all the rest of us. Here's a piece of data that the global output is valued at $75 trillion. That's the global gross product, $75 trillion, right? The whole country's world's people and all the countries in the world produce that amount of goods and services that people actually can and need to consume. Now, speculation, just in derivatives, if that's a technical word, we don't need to go into what it means, but it's simply a speculative activity having nothing to do with real production of goods and services, is valued at $1.2 quadrillion. So the real economy is $75 trillion. Just that type of speculation is $1.2 quadrillion. And there's all kinds of other speculation. So this wild speculation, unproductive, in which the stock market reaches new heights while all of us are moving down, that has been a response to this crisis of over accumulation. So has been increased spending on military, on transnational systems of social control, warfare, and repression. That's what I call accumulation by repression and accumulation by militarization, meaning that the systems of repression, including repression against the anti-racist uprising here, and so forth and so on, are also a way for capitalism in the face of stagnation to continue to accumulating, to continue functioning. Right? It's an outlet, a dangerous outlet. And that brings us to this discussion of the threat of fascism. So we all agree now. I've been writing and warning about the threat of fascism since early this century, and really after 2008, the financial collapse of 2008. And now, finally, it's right before our eyes. We all agree now that this threat is real and it is imminent. But we need to see fascism as a particular far-right response to this crisis of global capitalism. It was a far-right response to the 1930s crisis of capitalism in Germany, in Italy, and elsewhere. And now it's a response to this crisis. But a particular response that seeks, and these are the key things, to rescue capital from this organic crisis by violently restoring capital accumulation and by suppressing threats from below, unencumbered by democratic constraints, and violently establishing a new form of state legitimacy. And the key thing about a fascist project, and this is what we see so clearly right now in the United States, is that it brings together three things. It brings together capital, in this case, transnational capital, its economic, its class interest. It brings that together with reactionary and repressive political power in the state. And of course, that's Trumpism here, it's Modi in India. And this is the key point, linking up with a fascist mobilization in civil society. And that's what we're seeing in the fast track right now. You mentioned it at the beginning of the interview, the extrajudicial execution of anti-racist protesters, this attempt by far-right fascist paramilitary group to storm the Michigan state capitol and kidnap the governor and other officials and, according to their plans, assassinate them. All of these things is showing this fusion of this paramilitary violent fascism mobilizing in civil society and linking up with the state. So finally, on this issue of fascism, why do people, right? Why is there a mass base for fascism in the United States? Why was there in Germany? That's where we have to see the...
Mm-hmm. Before we go there, can you explain to us how is it that fascism helps resolve this crisis of overaccumulation in capitalism?
Well, in the long run, it doesn't. It does not at all, because it's linked to war and it's linked to repression. So it doesn't resolve the crisis of overaccumulation. What it does is it addresses the political, the cultural, the social dimensions of that crisis in defense of the system. But that's also the key difference between 21st and 20th century fascism. In Germany, there's a deep crisis. Germany got hit by the Great Depression. Well, the Nazis were on the rise throughout the 1920s, but was not yet a mass movement with any possibility of taking power until the Great Depression hit in the early 1930s, and it hit Germany even harder than other countries. So that was the recruitment basis for fascism. What the Nazis did is to mobilize resources for the giant German industrial and financial combines. By mobilizing that from the state and by making war, massive war, there was an outlet for capital to continue to accumulate. So it momentarily resolved the situation of stagnation by military spending and by a fascist, also the other things that happened to Germany is the total repression and elimination of the socialist and communist and trade union resistance. Now, in 21st century fascism, the Trump fascist project cannot, this is a key point, cannot resolve this structural crisis of overaccumulation. And this is really critically important. If I may, Jonathan, may I go back to what I was saying, what is this mass base of fascism, and show how, even though Trumpism has a mass base, it cannot resolve the structural crisis or the political and social crisis.
Right. So, yes, please.
So what is, you know, so what is the mass base of fascism? Well, the key to understanding the fascist appeal to some sectors of the population is a promise to restore stability and security and relieve mass social anxiety at a time when capitalism is in crisis, and that crisis is destabilizing the social and economic conditions of vast and swathes of the population. So there's this psychosocial mechanism of sublimating this mass anxiety at times of downward mobility, social economic destabilization, into a fascist project which scapegoats communities and scapegoats internal enemies. So the idea here is that you have to displace the mass fear and anxiety generated by capitalist crisis onto something else. So that's what we see so clearly right now. Just take the example of Trump, the fanatical build the wall rhetoric and the massive ideological and political, you know, racist campaigns against immigrants is an attempt to channel this mass anxiety and disaffection that could be turned against the system itself, that could develop into a radical consciousness towards scapegoating, towards outness. And we know that it involves a repertoire of extreme nationalism and national regeneration. Germans called it that. The Nazis called it that, German regeneration. Trump calls it Make America Great Again. Xenophobia, race, culture, supremacy, and racism plays a key role here. Martial masculinity, millennialism, a culture which normalizes, glorifies, and even glorifies war, social violence, and domination. But now here's the key difference. This is the culmination of the point I want to make, that there were very different circumstances in Germany and elsewhere, in Italy and elsewhere in the 1930s, where a fascist project could mobilize resources and could put unemployed German workers back to work, could give a material payoff to that sector of the German population that was considered Aryan and therefore the privileged group. So there was some material benefit at the beginning for this mass social base to support fascism, not in the long run. But here in the US and anywhere around the world now with this new globalized stage of world capitalism, there's no material payoff whatsoever. These disaffected, and what are the social base in the US is that previously privileged white and disproportionately male sectors of the working class in the United States were previously privileged. And now they are experiencing complete destabilization. They have no future in global capitalism. So their only wages of this social base of Trumpism is a psychological wage. And so a fascist project in the United States is not stable. Finally, I just conclude with this, that the racist and fascist, the racist for the mass social base of a would-be fascist project to buy into that project is not something automatic. That racist fascist response to crisis is not automatic. The ruling groups, the extreme right, and this is the key role of Trump, who is charismatic, not for you and me, but for his mass base, has to put out an interpretation of the crisis. Interpretation of capitalist crisis, okay, to a false interpretation. And when they put out the false interpretation and talk about capitalist crisis, and that's why Trump talks about how people have lost their jobs and banks are taking over and the wars were bad. All of this is to put out a certain a false interpretation of the crisis, a racist fascist interpretation, but one which identifies real suffering among this particular base. And this is why this is the crisis that we're facing on the left. We need to put out an alternative interpretation of this crisis to a would-be mass social base for fascism. Yet the left is extremely weak. The socialist left, the radical left, we don't have that power to have our alternative interpretation of this crisis really have the same effect as the fascists in power.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Professor William Robinson, Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and we're talking about the structural underpinnings of fascist currents domestically. And later on, we're going to talk about how this is manifested around the world, but also what we can do about it. Part of what you've mentioned, Professor Robinson, is that here in the United States, the answer and explanation offered by Donald Trump, but also the ring of politicians around him. I'm thinking of Steve Miller and others. They cannot offer material responses to the base they are speaking to, a base that is suffering economically and has an enormous amount of anxiety about the future. And they're answering that call with scapegoating of immigrants, but also a hearkening back to America as it was in the 1950s, Make America Great Again, an enormous amount of racism and white supremacy around crime, dog whistling, repression, the deployment of police, to pretty much put down protests in places like Portland, Chicago, and elsewhere. You're saying that unlike in the German example, in which the German state was able to offer some level of material response, we don't have that capacity for all kinds of different reasons here in the United States. So what happens to that fascist project? It flails about? What happens?
Right. Well, of course, you're asking us to peer into the future, right? This unknown future. But that's why also I have been arguing that this 21st century fascism won't look like 20th century fascism, because just as you put it, the project does not have the capacity to consolidate with its own internal logic and coherence. So it does flail about. But as it flails about, well, first, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Secondly, repression, including a move from more selective to mass repression, escalates. And third, the danger of war, deeper militarization and war. War maybe against China as a way of deflecting this incredible political and social tension to an external enemy. So,
but that's also a way of resolving this crisis of overaccumulation through war.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And although it might literally destroy humanity, or even if it doesn't, it would be tens or hundreds of millions of victims if the U.S. and China go to war. But yes, in the sense that war pulls capitalism out of recessions and depressions. And so it's dangerous. That's dangerous. There's this danger of a move towards war in two levels. One, that it will pull what really is a depression that we're entering into now out of depression. And secondly, it will deflect this challenge to the system towards an external enemy and towards a war mobilization. I mean, that's why we're at a moment of unbelievable inflection here. We're at a turning point, the United States, right, as here, but also humanity as a whole in this very moment and in the next few weeks and the next few months. So this is such a dangerous moment. It would be loaded with opportunities if we had a stronger left. I mean, that's another point for of discussion. But you were also mentioning the Steve Miller. I mean, he's an open fascist, so is Trump themselves. They're actually fascists, not just using a label there. But the Republican Party itself has long since been captured by what was the right wing of the party and pulled the party into a situation where I would consider the dominant force in the Republican Party are now fascist. And so the fascist project goes beyond the Trump White House. It includes the Republican Party at this point. If there's elements of the Republican Party that don't want to take the U.S. towards fascism. But it's now this point a fascist party. And here's the other thing also. This doesn't mean that the Democrats are good. At this point, they don't want to see a breakdown in the rule of law. They don't want to see fascism. But we want to remember that the Democratic Party program has been based on neoliberal capitalist globalization for three decades now, and war, and tax against workers, and an intensification of the policies that lead to inequality and therefore social conflict. So the Democratic Party has been feeding and throwing firewood on this fire of fascist mobilization. The Democrats are just as much as responsible for this upsurge, this insurgency of the fascist project, and for giving us Trump as are the Republicans themselves. So we're going into this election at this pivotal moment. The world is entering into economic depression. The pandemic is deepening, and we have this biggest threat ever of fascism in the United States. And if I know there's a big debate on the left, are these two parties equal? Should we not vote for them? In my view, is very clear. We need to vote for Biden and Harris, with the understanding that they're war criminals, the understanding they respond to the interests of Wall Street and Silicon Valley and the military industrial complex. They're not friends of the vast majority of war and poor people, working and poor people in the United States. But nevertheless, we need to get them to win the election so we have enough space to further beat back fascism, and hope that our mass mobilization could pressure them to go in a little different direction than Obama, the 8 years of Obama, and before that, the 8 years of Clinton took us. They really took us to the doorsteps of fascism.
That's the voice of professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Professor William Robinson. And we're talking about the crisis of capitalism domestically and globally and the economic underpinnings of fascist currents, which we see today. Can you give us a working definition of fascism?
Sure. Well, I'm going to say that it's going to be my working definition of fascism, because we have great different interpretations of fascism. But I think what anyone would agree with is fascism sees the breakdown of the rule of law and the lifting of democratic constraints, any constraints that there are, to the naked rule of capital and its political agents. So that's everyone, almost everyone would agree on that. We would all also agree that fascism involves those different ideological dimensions I was mentioning. There's no fascism without a racist mobilization. There's no fascism without extreme nationalism and national regeneration. Because why? When you have people identify with a nation, some unified nation, you do not have them identify with class and particular social and political positions against the rulers and against the system. Xenophobia is absolutely central. We spoke about that, race, culture, supremacy, and so forth. But my definition now, and this is where others may disagree, it is that it has to be seen as a response to capitalist crisis. And it has always been. That's a response. And again, it's a response which involves, for me, a triangulation. And so I'll reiterate here, because this is my clear working definition, a triangulation of transnational capital with this reactionary and repressive political power in the state, whether it was the Nazis in Germany, whether it's Modi now in India, whether it's Trumpism in the United States, that reactionary, repressive political power in the state, fusing with this fascist mobilization in civil society. So we have in Latin America, for instance, in Honduras and elsewhere, we have authoritarian and dictatorial governments, but not fascist governments, in the sense that in Honduras, you don't have a fascist mobilization, this mass fascist base in Honduras. You have the vast majority of the population objecting to this, dictatorial regime of the elite in Honduras backed by the United States. That's not fascism. So fascism takes it that step further, where you have a mass fascist mobilization in civil society. So the would-be opponents of capitalism, of the system, those most who have real suffering and real oppression, are led to a different consciousness of that oppression and that suffering, and a different program to solve it, which is false. That's why the wages of fascism are just psychological. It's not, at this point, material. So if you look at, you want to see the difference, I mean, if you want to imagine it like this, imagine Trump wins once again, and these forces do manage to storm, we move into civil war, these forces do manage, such as the Wolverine people in Michigan, to storm state capitals. We move into this fascism, you know, on the streets. We're seeing it now, but imagine this generalized, it's deepened with a new Trump victory. So that looks different than a Democratic win and the neoliberal and war abroad model that we had previously.
What do you think is the shortcoming of the left in this period? Why do you think the left has been prostrated in this period and unable to offer an alternative? And isn't Black Lives Matter an Antifa that left alternative?
No. Okay, so we're going into one territory that would require much more discussion than I know we can get into now. So I'm going to be brief, and by being brief, I'm simplifying. So I really want to state that. But neither Black Lives Matter nor Antifa is an alternative to a socialist left. It is part of a mass uprising, and I want to get into that in just a moment. But we have to take this back historically. And, you know, when we look back in history to understand where we got to the present, that's part of a revolutionary analysis. You have to go back in history. You can start the story with 2020. So we did have, course, in the 1930s, a powerful mass left, and we still had mass left and more radical understandings of what's going on with the mass struggles of the 1960s and 1970s. And I previously pointed out that capital goes transnational. A new transnational capitalist class emerges in the 1980s and on, specifically to weaken that mass rebellion of the 60s and 70s from below and to reestablish the class power of this new transnational bourgeoisie. But what happened here is that with that also, with this counteroffensive of transnational capital, neoliberal capitalist globalization offensive, certain sectors among these mass social and political struggles space is opened up for them. And in particular, we always see that organic intellectuals play a key role in movements of social change, whether they're in a left direction or in a right direction. There's always organic intellectuals. These organic intellectuals identified with the mass struggles of the 60s and 70s, and before that, the trade union, socialist, communist struggles of the 1930s and 1940s. Within the face of neoliberal capitalist globalization, what I call the intellectual petty bourgeoisie they took a defeatist attitude, moved into universities, severed the ties to any real mass working class militant movements and the larger society and economy, and came up with explanations for how we move forward, how we transform society, how we identify social justice and racial justice, which have gotten us nowhere, which are completely divorced from a radical and a socialist left program. The other thing, and I, again, we need a lot more time for me to be able to say something and not be misunderstood in what I'm saying. So Black Lives Matter is not an organization with any one center anywhere. I mean, different people can say they formed in LA, right here in LA, Black Lives Matter, or Santa Barbara, Black Lives Matter. And the powers that be have done everything they can and are having significant success in co-opting Black Lives Matter identified leaders and centers around the country, and they've spent already $100 million since the George Floyd uprising started. $100 million to co-opt this movement into directions where they're not threatening to the system. So that's why you get corporate CEOs, including Jeff Bezos, the single richest man in the world, saying that he wants to introduce racial sensitivity training into Amazon, and he wants to have more Black faces in the Amazon board of directors. Because the corporate and political elite, which is killing us all. And by the way, the police violence in the streets is simply the coercive arm of the capitalist state and the corporate elite. They have no problem with a very mild agenda, which involves analyzing racism as interpersonal misunderstanding and as attitudes in the minds of white workers and middle class people, rather than racism as the whole structure of a racialized capitalism and labor and intensified labor exploitation. I mean, you can go on and on here. But the discourse put out by those among the Black Lives Matter leadership getting $100 million is a very mild discourse, which focuses on racism as this interpersonal aggression and misunderstanding and sensitivity training. Now, that's not, remember, 35 to 40 million young people and older ones, myself included, took to the streets over those months of the George Floyd protests. So I'm not referring to them. I'm referring to how the system is going to neutralize and co-opt and make unthreatening this mass anti-racist uprising. And it involves trying to co-opt leaders from Black Lives Matter into a program which is not threatening. Now, you asked about Antifa. Antifa also is not an organization. People can call themselves Antifa. Someone in Santa Barbara can say, let's start an Antifa movement here. So they're not organizations, even if Black Lives Matter or Antifa were not co-opted. That doesn't substitute. It's the movement for Black Lives generates wild enthusiasm among 30 million people, because that's showing the incredible willingness of the mass of people in the United States, working poor people of all colors, to challenge this system. They know something is deeply wrong. They know there has to be mass change from below. They know that the rulers are hovering over us and about to destroy us. But they have no critique of where is this threat really coming from? What unites all of these disparate multi-level struggles, at all different levels? And that's where a radical socialist left would put out that discourse. Black Lives Matter does not. Antifa does not.
So how do we build the infrastructure of the left, its organization, its base in labor, in communities and schools?
Well, I don't have the answer to that. I don't have the answer. What I can tell you, I recognize the limits of my own role. I analyze global capitalism. I analyze this crisis. I analyze how that is linked to social and political conditions and struggles here in the US and around the world. That's my role as an intellectual, trying to provide the inputs, the theoretical and analytical inputs. So I don't have the political answers to how we bring that about, but I do know, and again, this is where I was saying, one, we don't have enough time, and two, I'd have to tread very lightly, because without enough time, I'm setting myself up for misunderstanding. But we have a series of explanations for this crisis that humanity is in, which is pretty much hegemonic in the academy, in the U.S. And it's these explanations that go to get to these young people. They're ready to be radicalized, ready to challenge the system. And they get to these explanations, and I'm referring to very moderate, very liberal explanations that I mentioned already. Explanations that come out of theories which sound very radical, but their program is quite liberal, such as, privilege theory and so forth. You get all of these different explanations which are dominant in the academy. And right now, it used to be that when you go into higher education, you come from the more privileged classes in the United States. Now, higher education is a mass education. And starting with the crisis of 2008, higher education, the enrollment doubled, literally doubled, and is still continuing because young people have no jobs in the job market if they go right to the job market. So college has been a way of prolonging having to face a job market where there's nothing but misery, unemployment, underemployment, precarious employment. But what I'm getting at then is that the intellectual petty bourgeoisie throughout the universities in the United States, the majority, are giving an interpretation of this crisis and this enemy, which is very mild, very liberal. A diversity agenda, saying get more Black and Latino faces into corporate boards and into political positions, rather than in the least bit challenging the social and economic structures that generate inequality, that generate police violence, rather than having any critique of capital and capitalism. And this is different than the 1960s. I know I'm talking too much here, but I wrote an article just a little while ago in which I was warning that the Black Lives Matter uprising is going to be co-opted and defeated without a more radical understanding of what racism is, what structural racism is, where it comes from. And I quoted in that article Fred Hampton. We all know who Fred Hampton is now. He's the Chicago leader of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s. He was assassinated in 1969, extrajudicial execution while he slept in his bed. But the reason I'm raising that is that he was, I believe, and I think others, many others would agree, the most ideologically and politically advanced and theoretically advanced of the whole Black Panther Party leadership. And he famously, there's all these quotes that people are now drawing on. We famously said, if we don't confront capitalism, we're not doing anything about confronting racism. And we have to be clear, what first came is capitalism. Capitalism enslaved us to use our labor. So, and go and on and on. But here's the point. So in the 1960s, we didn't have revolution, 1970s, but at least the mass social movements led by the Black liberation movement had a critique of capitalism and linked the analysis of racism to the analysis of class. Now look at the dominant discourse. Again, there's 25, 30 million young people in the streets. It's not their fault. But what is the message they're getting? This has nothing to do with class. Don't even talk about class. Nothing to do with capitalism. That's not even on the radar. That's not on the radar. And so why? It's again goes to both the lack of a socialist, significant socialist presence among the masses raring to go at this point, but also to who are those leaders and those giving these masses a message. And that is for me this intellectual petty bourgeoisie, which is very comfortably ensconced in the academy and also in the media and so forth.
And yet there is a conversation about the abolition of the police, which itself would require a revolutionary program, given the role of the police in society.
Yes, and that's the contradiction. There's a discussion of the abolition of the police, there's a discussion of the abolition of mass incarceration, and if any of that were carried out, then suddenly Jeff Bezos would, corporate CEOs and the Democrats in Congress wouldn't literally take a knee. That's what they did. They wouldn't be saying, yeah, we want anti-racism training in the Amazon warehouses. Then if there was actually a program to abolish the police, then they're suddenly going to join the ranks of fascism because they need to defend the system. The corporate and political elite, the property owning class needs the police. There's a coercive arm to defend their property against the mass of the propertyless, structurally marginalized, surplus humanity, and the downwardly mobile working class. But here I once again want to go back to what look what is being said from those getting their message out, not myself, about the police. First of all, it's not abolition of the police. And yes, it is positive, but the analysis, absolutely, by the way, I absolutely support the demands to defund and even abolish the police. That's not the problem. The problem is the police are not understood as simply the coercive arm of the capitalist state. You see the police when poor people, homeless people are beaten, when protesters are beaten, what they see is the police. They don't see corporate boardrooms. They don't see foundations. They don't see the Ford and Rockefeller foundations that and the Heritage foundations that designed the neoliberal program and capitalist globalization and anti-worker and regressive tax policies. And so forth and so on. So the demand to abolish the police is completely sanitized of the critique that the police is an coercive instrument of the capitalist state. Their role is to defend property from the propertyless. So none of that consciousness is there. And as a result, once the system fights back, both through coercion and seeing that nonstop, but also with these efforts of co-optation. And I repeat, $100 million to Black Lives Matter from these foundations, whose objective is to dilute this mass struggle so it's not a threat to the system, and to channel an anti-racist struggle to sensitivity training and to simple diversity within the actual economic and political structures of power.
You're listening to the voice of Professor William Robinson, and we're talking about the current economic and political conjuncture, but also the underpinnings of inequality and the rise of fascist currents domestically and around the world. Professor William Robinson, thank you so very much for sharing so much of your time with us.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me on.
That's the end of our show for today. We hope to open up the lines tomorrow to discuss this interview. I'd love to hear your reactions, and perhaps you have questions. You've been listening to non-commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. This show is produced by Adamo Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, and Andrea Hidalgo. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for tuning in to A New Day. See you tomorrow.
My friend, what's on your mind? Tell me, where do you want to go? Your greatest dreams can take you there. Don't give up if good dreams defer. Someone will try to bring you down. They say dreams are for those who sleep. Oh, but dreamers possess great powers untold. They build worlds others cannot see. Remember, if you
You are tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free, community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. A very, very interesting program, A New Day with Johanna Fernandez. And before that, Good Morning Weber York with